It's a great honour to be invited to give a presentation in this series and to talk about open access with you and to discuss some of its implications. What I want to do today is give a brief introduction to open access, but it will be very brief because you've already been discussing many of the issues surrounding open access. I want to give some details of recent initiatives that have been taking place. I then want to talk about some of the policy drivers, the public policy drivers that are affecting scholarly communication, because I think that's been one of the most interesting areas of development over the past few years. And then talk a little bit about some of the policy implementation that's taking place around the world, but with a focus on Europe. And then finally, to end, to give some speculations on the future of scholarly communication and perhaps what the role of the library might be in that. You've already had an introduction to Spark Europe. Actually, I think it was 1998 that Spark was originally formed. It was under the auspices of the Association of Research Libraries in the US. It was formed very much as a reaction to the pricing crisis, the fact that libraries couldn't afford to purchase access to information. But we have developed very much more into looking at new models such as open access. Originally, the focus was on science, technical, and medical publishing because that was perceived to be the area where most of the problems occurred. But we've been, over the past few years, really expanding to look at arts and humanities, social sciences as well. Also, the original focus was on journal articles and the journal literature. But again, we've been expanding, looking at monographs, beginning to look at open textbooks and data and such like. But again, the primary focus is on the journal literature. So the revolution, one of the revolutions in my title refers, of course, to the revolution of the internet, which is, of course, naturally now a cliche, but one that I'm still going to use. The way in which scholars communicate with each other, the way in which information is disseminated between researchers has obviously changed dramatically over the last 10 years with the introduction of the internet. We have new means of disseminating research. We have perhaps better ways of handling the increase that Greg mentioned in the amount of research that is being published. At the moment, well, actually, over the past 100 years, the research literature has grown by something around about 3 or 4% each and every year. It's been quite a constant growth over that period, and that means it doubles every 14 years. The old business models don't particularly handle that growth very well. Now 90% of journals, peer-reviewed journals, are available online. The figure is slightly higher for the science, technical, medical field, slightly lower for arts and humanities, but the average for the 22,000 or so peer-reviewed journals that are in existence is about 90%. But unfortunately, what we have at the moment is this new technology, this new means of disseminating research, married to old business models of subscription, either at the individual title level or at the big deal consolidated level. And that's a marriage that doesn't really work particularly well and is coming under increasing strain. So as already been pointed out, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with authors not reaching their peers, despite the fact that often they have to pay for publication. Many journals charge page charges, they charge colour figure charges, they charge reprint charges. And in some fields, especially in the biomedical fields, these charges can amount to many thousands of dollars. So they're paying for publication, but they're also paying in another sense because in many cases they're having to give up their copyright or they're having to sign exclusive licenses with the publishers. So that means that they are limited in what they and their colleagues can then do with their own research. So they're paying in two ways. Readers are dissatisfied because they don't get access to all of the literature. Libraries are dissatisfied because even the wealthiest libraries can't meet the information needs of all their users. The funders of research are dissatisfied because they want to see greater returns on the investment they make in research, and we all lose out because these communication channels are not optimized. So it's because of that dissatisfaction that open access has really become a hot topic over the past few years. And what is it? Well, you know that it's the call for free and unrestricted access to the literature that scholars give to the world without expectation of payment, and that's the important thing, that's the unique feature of this literature, that authors are publishing for prestige and kudos. They're not publishing for direct financial reward or for royalties. Why do we say open access is a good idea? Well, you can begin to think of many benefits, widening dissemination, accelerating research, enriching education, because students will have access to more information, sharing learning amongst the rich and the poor countries, and enhancing the return that we make as taxpayers on the investment that we make in research. And how do we do it? Well, we use the funds that are in the system at the moment, and the journals market worldwide is worth something round about $10 billion a year. We use those funds to pay for the dissemination of research rather than to pay for access to research. And as you know, the classic statement of open access was the Budapest Open Access Initiative from February of 2002, and it described the two strands, the two complementary strategies towards achieving open access. So self-archiving, where researchers can deposit copies of their own papers into electronic archives that have been built to internationally agreed interoperability standards, and open access journals, so these are journals that place no barriers between the readers and the research, but they look to other sources of revenue to cover the publication charges. If I take those two strands one at a time and start again with institutional repositories, obviously they have a number of features. They're institutionally defined, so the content generated by the institutional community. Scholarly content and institutional repositories can contain a wide range of outputs, everything from preprints and working papers through peer-reviewed papers, teaching materials, theses, data sets, and such like. Despite the fact that they can contain a wide variety of material, I'm going to focus very much today on the peer-reviewed journal articles. They're, like any good repository, they're cumulative and perpetual, and then they're interoperable and open access, so interoperable, so the material within them can be found and retrieved, and open access, they're freely available, so any interested reader can get access to them. And if you start to think about what some of the benefits of institutional repositories are, you can think of benefits at a number of different levels for different players within the system. For the individual, they provide a central archive of their work. Because the papers are discoverable, they improve discoverability and retrieval, which in turn will increase the dissemination and the impact of their research, and in that way acts almost as a full CV for the researcher. In a similar way, for the institution, they increase the visibility and prestige. I'll be interested to know over how many journal titles the research output of this university is spread. I imagine it's hundreds, if not thousands, of different journals each year. So that intellectual wealth has been diffused across thousands of titles. By having copies in an institutional repository, it brings together all of the intellectual wealth of an institution. And that, in many ways, acts as a shop window for that institution. It acts as an advertisement for external funding sources, for new students, for new researchers, and such like. Institutional repositories are also finding fans amongst university administrators, because it's actually a useful way of streamlining administration processes, especially research assessment and evaluation. In the UK, very few of our universities maintain centralized lists, publication lists of what's the outputs of their researchers. And that makes research assessment exercises very, very difficult and very time-consuming. Because the university has to actually find out what it has published over the past few years. By having all the material in an institutional repository, that obviously makes that a lot easier. And so for society, we get access to the world's research literature, and we hope that it would ensure the long-term preservation of institutions' academic output, because by putting the onus on archiving into the institution, we're putting it in organizations that have long histories of being very, very good at archiving material. So I said that I'd focus very much on journals, and to look at how institutional repositories can help with the journal literature, it actually helps to take a step back and to ask the question what it is that a journal actually does. And this, again, I'm sure is very familiar to all of you, but traditionally the scholarly journal is said to fulfill four different functions. There's a registration function and establishing intellectual priority. So I've done a piece of research and I want to establish the fact that I've done this research. The certification, so I want it to be noted that my peers consider this to be a valid piece of research. There's awareness. I want all of you to know that I've done this research, and there's archiving. So I want people in 10, 50, 100 years to know that I was the person who did this piece of research. And the current subscription models integrate all of those functions into what we call the traditional journal. And in the print environment, that made perfect sense. It was the most efficient and cost-effective way of fulfilling those functions. But as I said earlier, 90% of journals are now available online. And now that we're in an online environment, we can ask the question whether or not it still makes sense to integrate all of those functions into one package. And it may come as no surprise to learn that I think the answer is no, it doesn't make sense. If you think about a researcher depositing a copy of their preprint, so a peer-reviewed paper into an institutional repository, you can see that it's already fulfilling three of the four functions of a traditional journal. They've registered their intellectual priority because the institutional repository gives a date stamp to the research. The material within the repository can be picked up by search engines, so there's an awareness function so people can find the research. And there's an archiving function because the institution has taken responsibility for the long-term archiving of the material. Now, long-term electronic archiving is still a little bit of a vexed question, and we haven't got all the answers to that, but my suggestion is that by putting the emphasis and the onus on the institution, it's actually better. You have more chance of long-term archiving than putting the onus on, say, a commercial organisation. So maybe there should be half a tick there, but I think there's definitely a tick for archiving. The one part that's obviously missing is certification. So that's the idea of independent international peer review. You don't get that if you deposit your paper into an institutional repository. Our certification is obviously important for authors and for readers. It's important for authors because it validates their research, it validates their work. And that's an important point for their next grant proposal, for their promotions and such like, you know, the fact that they're doing high quality research. It's also important to readers because readers use the brand of a journal as an initial quality filter. If you do a search, you get 20, 30 papers coming back, and you see that one has been published by Nature, you're already beginning to have some notion of what type of paper that should be. Now, obviously, there isn't a one-to-one correlation between the title of the journal and the quality of the research that's published within that journal, but it gives you some sort of idea. So certification is vital to both authors and to readers, and the journals provide the peer review service. They provide the quality stamp to the research and to the authors of that research. And we're saying that the journal should be open access because there's no point in building access barriers around the research if that research is then also freely available within institutional repositories. So the journal should be open access. And so you can see that the combination of institutional repositories and peer review services provided by the open access journals are providing the four functions of the traditional journal. Now there'll be some blurring of the responsibilities here because there'll be some awareness. You'll get some awareness from publishing in the open access journal, and some open access journals have long-term archiving agreements with national libraries, and so you'll get an archiving function there, so it's not as clear-cut as I've suggested in this slide, but there is still this combination of institutional repositories and open access journals are fulfilling the traditional functions of a journal. So you can begin to see how it all works together. You have an author who deposits a copy of their paper into an institutional repository or maybe a discipline-based repository. These repositories are built to agreed interoperability standards, and you have a series of services that are provided by different players in the system. There's the registration that's provided by the institution because the institution is hosting the repository, certification by the journals, and the journals could be run by commercial organisations. They could be run by scholarly societies. Or by small groups of researchers in the way that journals are at the moment. There's awareness through searching tools and linking. You know, the searching tools could be Google. And archiving, by the library. But at no point is there any barrier placed between the reader and the research. So this is our sort of utopian vision of how open access works. And what I wanted to do next is talk a little bit about some of the implementation that's actually putting this into practice. And again, let me start with institutional repositories and start with the directory of open access repositories, OpenDAW, which is hosted by the University of Nottingham in the UK. It provides a directory of open access academic repositories that, that contain peer-reviewed output. At the moment, there's something around about 1,400 repositories listed. When I last checked last week, it was 62 of those came from Australia. You can use OpenDAW to search across content in all listed repositories, but I think more interestingly, it actually gives some information on repository policies, such as copyright information, reuse of material preservation, and such like. And there are policy tools there that help you to construct policies for institutional repositories. So it will give examples of what a best practice policy would be on copyright, for example. And this is a map showing the distribution of those 1,400 odd institutional repositories. There are the sort of focus of intense activity that you might where you might expect them, but also you can see that it is definitely a worldwide endeavor. So there's institutional repositories all over the place, including some rather surprising places in the world. I might have to check to see exactly what's going on there. On the journals front, there's a similar directory. This is the Lund Directory of Open Access Journals, hosted by Lund University in Sweden. And it now lists over 4,000 open access peer-reviewed titles in a wide variety of subjects, everything from arts and humanities through to particle physics. So 4,200 out of 22,000 journals, peer-reviewed journals in total, is still a relatively small fraction. But the interesting thing about this is that it's growing dramatically. So the numbers, every time I do a presentation, I have to check the directory and have to update the numbers. And over the past few years, there has been a dramatic growth. So it's still a relatively small proportion, but it's a rapidly growing proportion. And I just wanted to highlight two or three of the publishers who are publishing open access journals. The first is perhaps one of the most famous. This is the Public Library of Science. They're a not-for-profit organization. They launched their first journal in 2003, and their remit was, or their desire really, was to prove that you could have very high-quality open access journals. It's sort of rather surprising, in a way, to think back to 2003, and to think about how there were some people who were suggesting that open access journals couldn't be high quality, almost by definition. And that was one of the myths that PLOS tried to demolish, and they have been spectacularly successful in demolishing that. The PLOS titles now have some of the highest impact factors in their fields. Biomed Central is a commercial publisher. So open access is not an anti-commerce movement. Biomed Central is a commercial publisher. It's published over 55,000 papers. It was recently purchased by Springer, which I think shows how open access is moving into the mainstream of scholarly publishing. At the other extreme, there's Documenta Mathematica, which is run by a single academic out of a maths department in a German university. But the single academic has really put in place rigorous quality control and peer review. And so the journal now is in the top 25 of the maths journals as listed by ISI. One of the things that we did last year was we wanted to ensure that the voice of open access publishers were heard in the debates surrounding open access. Because quite often the debate is characterized as being polarized between open access advocates and the publishers. And we wanted to show that actually a lot of publishers now are embracing the ideas of open access. So we helped launch the Open Access Scholarly Publishers Association, who are having their first conference later this year. Most of the journals listed by the Directory of Open Access Journals were born open access, and they're completely open access. But there's also another model, which is a hybrid model, which is where subscription journals give authors the choice. So if the authors are able and willing to pay a publication charge, then the paper is made open access immediately on publication. If they're not able or willing to pay that charge, then the paper is only made available to subscribers in the traditional means. Over time, the idea is that as the proportion of authors who are willing and able to pay increases, then the subscription price can fall, and eventually the journal may be able to move to 100% open access. And the idea behind this was it was a very low-risk way in which publishers could transform their journals from subscription-based journals to open access. And a lot of traditional publishers are experimenting with this model. Perhaps most famously, the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences, but also Oxford University Press and some commercial publishers. I think the interesting thing, the interesting one out of that list is Oxford University Press, who have been very open about the uptake and success of their program. They find that it varies very much by discipline. So they have a very low uptake in the arts and humanities, but in the biomedical field, they have a very high uptake, with some journals having some up to about a quarter of the papers now being open access. And for some of their titles, like bioinformatics, the price has the subscription price has decreased over the past 2 or 3 years. So they've been honest in reducing the subscription price as they get other revenue streams. There is a logical chain of thought that says that if you make a paper more freely available, if you make it open access, then more people will have access to it, will be able to read it, will be able to download it, and therefore will be able to cite it. And there's some evidence to suggest that logical chain of thought is actually correct. And we're seeing that evidence in both the self-archiving front and journals. So let me give you two examples. The first of these comes from the Astrophysical Journal, where about 72% of the papers published in that journal have versions of the papers are available for free through the Physics Archive. And the Physics Archive is a discipline-based repository. Those papers for which there are free versions are on average cited twice as often as the remaining 28% that don't have any free versions. Now, it's slightly complicated in teasing out the cause and effect here. And it may be that the people who write the better papers are better citizens and were willing to deposit their papers into archive. So it may be that these were originally actually better papers. But there does seem to be some evidence that suggests that part of the reason that they're cited on average twice as often is that they there are free versions. And actually, Tim Brody from the University of Southampton has shown this type of effect across a wide range of subject areas. On the open access journals side, I mentioned that PNAS offers authors this option as to whether or not they want to make their papers freely available. Those papers that are freely available are downloaded more than 50% more often than the titles that are not, and are cited on average twice as likely again. So again, you have to try and work out what the causes of this are, but there does seem to be a real effect here that if you make your paper open access, either through repositories or through open access journals, you will see an increase in the number of downloads and citations to the papers. So what are institutions doing in response to some of these developments within open access? Well, on the self-archiving side, institutions are setting up and maintaining institutional repositories, and I know this has been a very successful area within Australia, where I think now all of the Australian universities have institutional repositories in place. Many institutions are helping the researchers to deposit their papers into the repositories, both new and old papers, so retro-digitizing where necessary. And they're helping to implement open access policies, and I'll say more about policies later. On the open access journals front, the institutions are helping to promote the journals that are launched within their own institutions externally to make sure that they're more widely known, and also ensuring that researchers within the institution know about the open access resources that are available externally. On the journals front, one of the easiest ways that an institution can do that is to take the records from the Directory of Open Access Journals and import them into the local library catalogues. A number of institutions are creating accounts to hold funds to pay for open access publication charges. So this is where funders are making money available for publication charges, and the institution will organise a fund to hold those, an account to hold those funds. Universities such as Nottingham in the UK are doing this. I say where applicable because only about half of the titles listed in the DOAJ charge publication charges. The rest look to other sources of revenue to cover their publication costs, and the for those titles, the publication is free to authors. And many institutions are engaging with politicians and funding bodies to raise the issues of open access. So I wanted to turn now to policy issues, and I wanted to talk both about some of the high-level public policy drivers that are changing scholarly communications, and also talk about the implementation of open access policies. I think there's a number of external drivers that are beginning to impact upon our world of scholarly communications. One of the major ones, and one of the reasons why politicians and policymakers over the last few years have become very interested in scholarly communications, is this whole idea of the knowledge economy, the idea that in economies where we don't actually make things anymore, manufacture things, then knowledge becomes a commodity and becomes an important part of the economy. And in Europe, we have what's known as the Lisbon Agenda. So this is where, back in 2000, the heads of the European countries came together and said that by 2010, Europe was going to be the most competitive knowledge economy in the world. The way they were going to do that was to increase the amount of money on research and development. They were going to ensure that there was a smooth flow of information out of universities and into industry, and also a smooth flow of information and knowledge across national borders. And now, in fact, the mandarins within Europe talk about a fifth freedom, and the fifth freedom is the freedom of knowledge flowing across national boundaries. Back in 2010 seemed a very long way away, and a very convenient date to set a target for. In 2009, it doesn't seem quite so far away, and the Commission has now acknowledged that they're not going to meet that target and probably not going to be the most competitive knowledge economy in the world. But I think that failure aside, it's indicative of this type of thinking that many governments are entering into now. And so knowledge is becoming a key component of many countries thinking about how they can move forward into the future. And as they spend more money on research and development and on education and such like, the issues around accountability and assessment become ever more important. The idea that we should be getting value for money and being able to prove value for money and demonstrate value for money is becoming more and more important. That's really driving in the UK our research assessment exercise and its new form, the Research Excellence Framework. I think that we're now adopting your model shortly after you've abandoned the model. As far as I can see, most countries around the world are chasing each other, sort of adopting each other's models and then trying to work out the best one. The Research Excellence Framework in the UK is going to be more metrics-based rather than peer-reviewed-based. Well, that was the idea. It now looks as if it's going to be a mixed model, but depending on the subject area, it's not entirely clear yet. But open access is one of the things that is being used and being seen as a way of providing value for money. If you can show that your research is being used by the wider community, then that's a way of showing value for money. E-science and e-research is a real driver, this idea that people are going to collaborate much more across discipline boundaries and across geographical boundaries. They're going to data mine, they're going to be able to use different resources, whether they're distant apparatus like telescopes, or whether it's computing facilities and such like. You know, you're not going to just use what you have locally. And if you're going to do that, if you're going to do real e-science and e-research, then you need access to resources. And if you're going to collaborate with people halfway around the world, you need access to the same types of resources. So open access then becomes a driver for e-science and e-research. There's lots of concern at the moment about access to data and about public sector information. So this is climate information, for example, census information, all that type of public information. And the idea there is there's a growing trend that suggests that if you make that type of information freely available, it's actually better for the economy because then businesses can use it and build upon it and create value and tax returns. So there's that, I think, is beginning to impact on scholarly communications. There's a freedom of information culture. There's a growing culture that citizens have a right to know what their governments are doing. And scholarly communications, I think, will be slightly tangential to scholarly communications, but I think that is going to impact upon us. And then there's the social agent, the Facebook generation, this idea that people are very happy sharing information with each other, irrespective of the copyright regime under which that information was created or who owns that information. People want to share information and they want to be able to do it easily. So I think those are the types of drivers that we're seeing from without that are impacting upon scholarly communication. And that's why we're seeing an ever-increasing number of open access policies being developed at a number of different levels, from the research group right through to national and international bodies. And one of the very first manifestations of this was the Berlin Declaration in support of open access from October 2003. This came out of a number of German research funders who realized, as this first bullet point says, that their mission of disseminating knowledge is only half complete if the information is not made widely and readily available to society. And it's interesting, I think, because this was one of the first times that the funding bodies realized that dissemination was a key part of research. Previously, they've been very happy to fund research and for the researchers to publish it somewhere and maybe to write a final report, but they hadn't really inquired too closely as to what the dissemination mechanism might be for the research that had been published. So the signatories of the Berlin Declaration were encouraged to support open access in a number of different ways that I've mentioned. There are something like, there are 265 signatories worldwide, including funding bodies and institutions. There are none from Australia, which I thought was interesting, but then I thought more closely about it. And actually, many of the organisations that have signed the Berlin Declaration seem to consider signing as being the end point in the process, and that in signing it, they have fulfilled an obligation towards open access. Many of the people who I'm going to talk about in the next couple of slides, who are actually moving things forward, have not signed the Berlin Declaration. So there does seem to be an odd thing that signing the Berlin Declaration almost acts as an inertial break. So I'd like to congratulate you all on not having signed. So who has been doing things? Well, one of the first funders to really push things forward and have acted in the vanguard has been the Wellcome Trust in the UK. The Wellcome Trust is the UK's largest charity. It funds research in the biomedical field, mainly in the UK, but also throughout the world, and spends about £400 million a year on research. And they became very interested in open access when the director of the Wellcome, Mark Walput, was sitting in his office in London, and he wanted to read the paper about a research project that the Wellcome had funded on malaria in the Gambia. He's a researcher. This was an area that he was particularly interested in. So he found the paper, it was online, he clicked on it, and he was asked for $30 to read the paper because the Wellcome didn't subscribe to the journal. And he thought, hang on a minute, I've paid for this research. We funded it completely, and I can't actually get access to it. That doesn't sound right to me. So that was his road to Damascus moment when he said, well, we need to really pursue open access. So from October the 1st in 2006, it became a condition of grant that if you receive funding from the Wellcome Trust, you have to make the original research paper freely available after 6 months, 6 months after publication. And so the way they're doing that is by depositing the papers into a centralized biomedical repository, in this case, PubMed Central. And it was the example of the Wellcome Trust that really inspired our research councils in the UK. We have 7 research councils, each one covering a different subject area, from arts and humanities right through to particle physics. It was the research councils that, the research councils now all have similar types of mandates in place. They're all slightly different, they're all slightly nuanced, but basically if you accept money from the research councils to do research, you then have to make the papers freely available. And similarly again, there's the National Institutes of Health in the US, the world's largest non-military funder of research. They spend about $30 billion a year in research, and they have a similar policy. If you accept NIH money, then you have to make a copy of your paper freely available up to 12 months after publication. And the amazing thing there is that that will mean something like 80,000 papers a year in the biomedical field will be made openly available. I checked to see what was happening here in Australia, and you know, all know this much better than I do, but there are 2 policies in place here. And you can see how policymakers like to cut and paste, because they use exactly the same language. They encourage researchers to consider the benefits of depositing their data in any publication. I'm afraid that when I was talking yesterday on this, I was slightly sarcastic about the encouragement to consider the benefits. I suggested that if I'm ever encouraged to consider the benefits of something, then it goes quite low on my list of things to do. Though it was pointed out to me that if on both of these policies, the bits I've missed out is that if people aren't encouraged to consider the benefits, then they have to explain why they're not depositing. I'd be interested to hear your views as to whether or not you think that's a strong policy or one that would be relatively simple for researchers to ignore. In Europe, the European Commission has, which is basically the civil service of the European Union, has a number of interesting open access policies. One is for the 7th Research Framework Program, which is a large research funding and program that's currently undergoing. And they're running a pilot there where about 20% of the projects will be made, the results of 20% of the projects will be made open access. And the idea here is that this pilot will inform the next research framework program, FP8, which will be coming in the next few years. And the idea will be that all material coming out of FP8 will be made open access. The Commission also fund the European Research Council, which was recently set up in the last few years, and they've come up with right from the beginning, they put in place an open access policy where there's a 6-month embargo after publication for making material open access. And in Europe, we have an organization that represents all of the research funders across all of Europe. This is Eurohawks. And they have put in place a recommendation to all of their members that they should develop similar policies that will ensure open access to research. One of the most interesting things I think is in this first bullet point, in the last sentence in bold, where it's encouraging its members to reduce the embargo time to not more than 6 months and later to 0. So they recognize that the embargo period is a compromise position, and actually for the material to be most useful, the embargo should be reduced to 0 and that papers should be made freely available on publication. But it's not just funders who are putting in place policies, there's also research organizations and institutions. CERN, the particle physics laboratory just outside Geneva, is perhaps the most famous research organization that has an open access policy in place, where the researchers there are required to deposit papers in the CERN repository. Then individual institutions, most famous perhaps are Stanford, MIT, and the Harvard policies that we've already discussed. In the UK, the University College London is one of our top 5 universities and is now probably the most prestigious of our universities to have put a policy in place. And checking the eprints.org sign-up list, there appeared to be 5 university policies within Australia. If there are any missing, then do let me know and we can add them to the list. And the European University Association has made a recommendation to all universities in Europe that they should adopt institutional policies requiring deposit and self-archiving of papers into institutional repositories. The slides will be made available, by the way, so I'm not expecting anybody to have to try and copy URLs of ridiculous magnitude such as that. So open access, I would say, is now clearly a policy issue. There's a growing consensus between the funders of research and university administrators on the need for open access mandates. The funders see dissemination as part of the research process, and they're increasingly seeing the publication costs as research costs. Administrators see repositories as a useful tool in supporting research and learning. And that's leading to a growth in the number of open access mandates that are being adopted. We're in an interesting lull period at the moment because a lot of these mandates apply to new research. And obviously it takes time for research after it's been funded to be performed and then to be written up and to be published. And so what we're seeing at the moment is this lull period, and then in the next few years we'll begin to see these mandates bearing fruit. And I think we're fast approaching the point where it'll be unusual for any leading institution or funder not to have a mandate. I think it's already got to the stage where it's unusual for any leading institution or funder not to be talking about having a mandate. And those policies and high-level support will underpin the work, the local work that's taking place in institutional repositories. So I suggest that open access is appealing to all of the major stakeholders, to the funders of research, to authors, as it gives them wider dissemination and impact, to readers, because they get access to all of the literature, to editors and reviewers, because they feel that their work is more valued, because it's seen more widely, to librarians, as it allows them to meet the information needs of their users, to institutions, as it increases their presence and prestige. And I think increasingly, the presence, the online presence of an institution is going to become more important, and it's going to be judged more, and people are going to be ranked by those types of metrics. More controversially, perhaps, I'm also suggesting that it's appealing to some small and society publishers, because as society publishers have to compete for an ever-decreasing proportion of a library's acquisitions budget, because more and more money is going to the big deals of from the large commercial publishers, it becomes harder and harder for them to maintain a subscription model. So actually, open access could be a model by which they can move and ensure their survival in the long term. You may notice that conspicuous by its absence is large commercial publishers from this list. Although I think that the fact that Springer has bought Biomed Central is an interesting indicator that some of them are thinking about how they can engage with open access in the long term. Everything I've spoken about so far has really, in many ways, been quite traditional. We're talking about new business models, we're talking about new ways of disseminating research, but we're still talking about, really, the traditional forms of research, so the traditional journal article. And so this, is, in many ways, has been a discussion about the evolution of scholarly communications. I want to spend the last few minutes quickly throwing open some ideas and speculations about some of the revolutions that could take place within scholarly communications. So there's new models in which publishers are interacting with repositories, and we've seen that with Nature setting up a repository service, Nature Proceedings. We've seen that with the Institute of Physics working very closely with the archive to put a front end on the archive. So this, we're getting to the stage now where publishers are not viewing repositories as necessarily a threat, but are looking at ways in which they can work together with them. We're also seeing new models coming for peer review and post-review analysis of papers. And one of the interesting models there is from the Public Library of Sciences is PLOS One. In many ways, it's a traditional journal, but what they'll do is they'll peer review the papers in a traditional way, but then publish them as long as they are technically sound. So there's no idea here that whether or not the paper suits the journal, whether it matches the journal's aims and scopes, because the basically PLOS One will accept papers in any subject area. So they're not rejecting papers that are technically sound just because they don't suit the title, or they don't suit the fashion that is currently within that subfield, or they don't suit the prejudices of the editor. And it's very interesting. And then on top of that, they have a post-publication annotation, discussion, and rating system on top of that. So the idea is that it should be the readers who decide the relevance of the papers. And interestingly, PLOS One is now only sort of 2.5 years old, but it's already one of the top five largest journals in terms of number of papers published each year. And at its current growth rate, it will become the largest peer-reviewed journal in the world next year. So what are the role of the library in all of this? Well, I would suggest that in an increasingly open access environment, the library's role should be to maximize the dissemination of authors' works, authors within the institution, and to promote the institution by promoting the research performed within the institution. I think the library can play an increasingly important role in the publication of research through organising peer review, alerting services, searching tools and such like. So this is almost a new form of the university press. The library can help to provide virtual research environments that take advantage of Web 2.0 tools and fulfil the e-science needs that I was talking about earlier of our researchers and our political masters. And obviously the library can take responsibility for long-term preservation. Now all of these new roles are going to require the library to reposition itself in the scholarly communication value chain and to develop new business models. Because the traditional business model of the library is to take money for acquisitions and to pay for acquisitions and access to information. And this is a very different role. One way of perhaps visualizing this came from Alma Swan in the UK, where she compared, for a number of different values, she compared the current position that repositories serve and what their potential offerings could be in the future, and compared that to publications. So if you look at the third one from the bottom, which is editorial value, at the moment repositories don't provide editorial value, journals do, but it may be that we could, by adding editorial functions on top of the repositories, then we can shift that so that the repositories are beginning to offer those types of services. So this is sort of like a way of thinking about some of the things, about some of the services that the repository might be able to offer in the future. So certification, for example, on top of papers deposited in repositories. And there was the Rioja project in the UK from last year, which tried to show how this would work. And they built an interface on top of Archive, which would allow researchers then to perform peer review on top of the papers published within Archive. Other things that we need to do on the repositories is to improve navigation and searching. We can provide editorial features, perhaps, similar to that provided by Biomed Central's Faculty of 1,000. So this is the idea that researchers pick out and highlight papers of interest to them and make those available to other people. At the moment, that's currently applied to the journal literature, but you could imagine it being applied to material which is in repositories, and then formalise archiving and preservation strategies, as I mentioned. So I'm talking about ways in which we can integrate research outputs into e-science and e-research. And to do that, we're taking content from repositories, both local repositories, repositories within our own institutions, and remote repositories. We're adding Web 2.0 functionality plus this desire for increased collaborative working from our users and researchers to create resources that serve the community in new and exciting ways, and providing not just content but complete research environments. I think the institutional repositories can become a real foundation for that infrastructure that allows e-science to take place. I just wanted to give you an example of this, which comes from the US. It's NanoHub. It's a resource for nanotechnologists. And it provides a wide variety of resources. There's research material, there's papers, there's conference proceedings, and the ability to have web meetings with collaborators. Nanotechnologists are very interested in running simulations. So you can look at other people's simulations and you can upload your own. There's teaching and learning spaces. The thing about this is that the the environment has been created, but a lot of the content comes from the users. So it's been updated up and it's being uploaded by the users themselves. So NanoHub describes itself as a rich web-based resource for research, education, and collaboration in nanotechnology. Provides a wide variety of resources, as I said, and is used by something like 90,000 nanotechnologists. I think one of the interesting questions is if this is a type of model that's going to be adopted by a variety of subject areas, who's going to provide it? In this case, it was a collaboration between a number of US universities. You could imagine perhaps university libraries wanting to move into this type of space. You could imagine commercial operators wanting to move into this sort of space. Maybe this could be a future direction for Elsevier and Springer, or scholarly societies. I think that we're in an interesting position at the moment where we can actually look at things like this and say, well, how much do we want this to be in the control of the academy, and how much are we willing to outsource it to other groups? So I think there's some very interesting experiments going on at the moment about how people collaborate. I mean, I haven't even touched on issues such as different forms of scholarly content, like scholarly wikis, for example, whether or not we think that Twitter can be of a scholarly value. If so, who's archiving it? Who's looking after it in the long term? So I think that those even further speculations are of interest as well, and we have to really look at very carefully at what the new forms of scholarly communications might be. I just want to end with two quotes, and the first is my favourite open access quote, which isn't about open access at all, but it was made by the first president of Johns Hopkins University, Daniel Colt Gilman, in 1878, so speaking well before any ideas of open access or about the internet. He was actually at that point speaking about the university press, and he said it's one of the noblest duties of a university to advance knowledge and to diffuse it not merely amongst those who can attend the daily lectures, but far and wide. That's really the underpinning of everything that we've been talking about on open access. This idea that we can begin to share the fruits of knowledge far and wide to diffuse them. And that was encapsulated really by the first line of the Budapest Open Access Initiative, which spoke of an old tradition, so the way in which peers communicate with each other, and the new technology of the internet have converged to make possible an unprecedented public good. We're just really at the starting point of realizing that public good. And there have been lots of very good examples so far in terms of repositories and open access journals. The number of repositories is growing, the amount of material within them is growing, the number of open access journals continues to grow, and we're seeing very, very good papers being published there. That public good is being supported now increasingly by policymakers and by university administrators. And I think it is now actually within our reach that within the next few years we can really transform scholarly communications. And the interesting thing for me is that that will just be the starting point. Because once we get to open access, then we can really begin to experiment and to try and do some new and exciting ways to revolutionize scholarly communication. Thanks very much.